Welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to Investing with Steve Davenport and Clem Miller. Every 2 weeks, Steve and Clem bring you brief investment insights you may not find anywhere else. We hope you enjoy today's episode. Here are Steve and Clem.
Welcome to Skeptic's Guide to Investing. In previous episodes, Clem and I have discussed NVIDIA, Apple, Microsoft, and Tesla. In this broadcast, we're going to discuss streaming service Netflix. Back when we had FANG as an acronym, Netflix was the N. Now, Netflix isn't in the Magnificent Seven. Clem, I know you hold Netflix in your portfolio, and I suspect many of our listeners subscribe to multiple streaming services. For example, Disney Prime or possibly YouTube Premium. Do you think Netflix streaming position is superior to these platforms?
So let me start off by saying that I recently read that the average household in the United States subscribes to 2.9 streaming services. So, you know, obviously it's not a question of picking one over others. So you're not going to have a situation, you know, in general where somebody picks Netflix over perhaps one of these others. But it's interesting to look at the stats. So Netflix, got Nestle on the mind, chocolate. Netflix has 260 million subscribers worldwide. Which is a bit more than the combination of Disney, Hulu, and ESPN Prime. They have 225 million, whereas the combination of Amazon Prime, MGM Plus has 205 million. So they're all sort of, I mean, even though Netflix is ahead of the other two, they're all sort of the, you know, a dominant oligopoly. But it doesn't stop there. YouTube Premium has 100 million. Max Plus and Discovery have 98 million. Paramount Global is 68 million. So, you know, the way I look at it, you have these different streaming services that offer, you know, somewhat different packages and sort of niches, you know, if they're, you know, maybe sports or, you know, Star Wars or Star Trek or, you know, things of that nature, whether they have, you know, old series, TV series that they're streaming. So you just have, or new programming, new content. And
I've noticed that on Netflix, I tend to get these movies and I don't know the actors and I look and then it ends up being in subtitles or voiceover.
Yeah.
And really, kind of annoying because you can tell that they aren't saying, you know, there's a little delay or yeah. I just would have thought that by now where we could create, you know, AI images, we'd be able to overdub a little better, you know?
Well, that's an interesting point, which brings me to another, I think, positive about Netflix. Even though, you know, even despite what you're saying, I think Netflix has done a much better job than the others of becoming a global streaming service. So generate content all over the world. And on top of that, they sell content all over the world. I talked to some friends who live overseas and they watch Netflix just like we watch Netflix here in the United States. So it's it's a global service. And with 260 million, I think there's a long runway ahead for Netflix being able to generate new subscriber growth.
Yeah, I've enjoyed watching some Irish shows, Derry Girls, Bad Sister, and some other ones, and I kind of enjoy the highlights and the way they do the cinematography is slightly different than in the U.S. So I kind of like the, you know, switching it up every now and then and watching another series from another country. Do you think that Netflix taps into that global market better than everyone else?
Yeah. Like I said, I think it certainly does. You know, as I was mentioning, you know, I do have, you know, friends overseas who watch Netflix And I know a lot of the content on Netflix, a good chunk of it anyway, is made overseas. And I think Netflix has a good cultural sensitivity that maybe some of the other networks who focus on U.S. niches might have less of.
Yep. So I guess you'd argue that despite the competition, Netflix has a wide moat. How does the moat translate into profitability and cash flow?
Yeah, so the net income margin, which is the net income or net profit divided by revenues, is a pretty strong 16%. Return on equity associated with that is 26%, which is really high, really strong. A really amazing cash flow generation, free cash flow margin is 57%. That is, for every dollar of revenue they generate, they produce 57 cents of cash flow that can be rolled back into the business or used to pay down to redeem shares. It's really a strong cash flow generating business.
So companies with strong cash flows and revenues are usually expensive. I see that Netflix 2024 PE is 35. It's not outrageous compared to some of the names, but it's still high. How do you classify it as being expensive, reasonable, or cheap?
So first of all, before we get into those value numbers, let me just say on growth, it generates 11% revenue growth annualized over the last 3 years. That's really strong. And 26% earnings growth, earnings per share growth. So that's pretty strong, which leads me to my point about valuation. Now, it may well be that in 2024, the PE ratio is 35, 36 times. Because of that growth rate, that PE ratio comes down over time. So in 2025, it's 29 times. 2026, it's 24 times. 2027, it's 21 times. So, that makes, going out into the future, that makes PE, certainly not unattractive. I'd say that Netflix is a bit expensive, but it's not terribly expensive compared to, some of the Magnificent Seven companies, some of the semiconductor stocks. So it's not unattractive on price. I'll also say that the PEG ratio, which only looks at the next year of growth, divides the PE for next year divided by the next year of growth, is 1.2 times. So that's not, that's actually pretty attractive.
So do you think they're going to be able to sustain this, though, and get into those numbers? I mean, when we talk about 2027, that seems like a long time away in terms of being able to predict when companies can't hit numbers one quarter away sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a lot of variation in this, but this is based on, analyst expectations over a long period of time. Analysts can be wrong. Sometimes they are wrong. But I'm giving you what the expectations are, and that's better than just guessing, right?
Yep, it's good to have something. Yeah. So you use Glassdoor employee satisfaction ratings as a proxy for company quality. How does Netflix fare in that? Do people like it there?
Yeah. I mean, Glassdoor has a 4.2 out of 5 rating. Anything above 4 is, indicates, very satisfied employees. So yeah, I mean, the Glassdoor rating indicates that employees are very satisfied. That's a high quality indication.
So one thing I was thinking about when we talked about doing this podcast was, is our lifestyle really changed when we went through COVID? So my wife and I, and this is just between you and me, Clem, but we started to watch
Love You and Me Blind. And everybody listening to this podcast.
And so my son was home and he said, why don't we watch Love is Blind, the latest season? And we thought, this is really not something we want to watch. But if we get to spend time with our son, we make an exception. And now we've gone back and watched the prior four seasons, and we're opening up the fifth season, and we're feeling like there's something very comforting about going on a binge streaming. And it reminds me of the times during COVID when you just felt like you had to stay put and you just kind of relaxed and, you know, allowed yourself some time to just get away. Do you think that we're going to see people ever change this kind of binging on streams of shows, or are they noticing any activity where people are getting back to normal? Or do you think we're at the new normal for people streaming and demand for streaming? Because it seems to me that if everybody started to exercise more and do more things, the area that would hurt would be the streaming time.
Well, yeah, obviously I can speak from my own experience, more so than about experiences in general. You know, my COVID experience was, yeah, I mean, we watched a lot more streaming on TV, but I also, during that period of time, got a lot of exercise, that because you couldn't go inside, you had to, you know, if you wanted to exercise, can't go to the gym, you'd have to walk around outside. So I don't think that there's necessarily it's not necessarily exercise versus streaming. You can do both. I think that, you know, the experience of the whole Barbenheimer, Barbie and Oppenheimer going to the theaters and so on this summer, you know, a lot of people were saying, well, the theaters are back. Honestly, I don't think they're back. I think those two movies coming out the same weekend, that was an exception, that proves the rule that the theater industry is going out. You may disagree, maybe others disagree, but I think the future, well, the present and continuing into the future is more streaming, and less going to theaters. I'll also say that I think that, you know, the biggest potential threat out there to the streaming services doesn't really come from other streaming services or from theaters. It comes from YouTube. Yep. Because a lot of people watch YouTube, and there's a lot of content there, including some really high quality content that
our content's
people are
there.
Watching. What?
Our content's there.
Yeah, our content's there.
No, it's pretty high quality.
Yeah, I'd say so. But you know, there's a lot of high quality stuff on YouTube, and I spend a lot more time watching YouTube than I do on streaming services. That's not necessarily true for other people, but for me, it's, you know, I find, you know, a very high degree of content, you know, on YouTube.
Well, yeah, I think that TikTok also, when, I don't know how, or if you have an opinion about TikTok being banned, but it feels to me like there are other substitutes for streaming, and they better watch out, because I think that, you know, a lot of these services like YouTube are, you know, only going to get bigger, and they seem to, their growth is just tremendous in terms of what they're producing. How do you feel about TikTok?
Well, there's two issues with TikTok. One is that, you know, unless they move to a longer format, I think that its prospects are fairly limited. A lot of people may disagree with that, but, you know, if you have very short videos, yeah, they can be interesting. Yeah, they can be addictive. But on the other hand, you know, how far can that go would be my question. Yep. Second thing is obviously the geopolitical aspect of it. And concerns about whether TikTok like Huawei and other things that emanate from China, whether there's a
Trojan horse.
Yeah, it's a Trojan horse, or, you know, I mean, that may be a good way to describe it, or whether there is data collection that we don't know about, or whatnot. And I don't really know. I don't know if that actually can be resolved by changing ownership of TikTok. You know, as long as somehow the Chinese companies or the Chinese government is in that mix, I don't know how you can potentially resolve that. And I really don't see U.S.-China relations improving. It's really the only thing that the Biden administration and the Trump people actually agree on. So I just don't see that that changing.
Yeah. So one of the last items of your analysis is usually about short seller interest. And how does Netflix have an acceptable short interest ratio?
Yeah, it's 1.84%, which is, you know, it's not as low as some of the other Magnificent Seven or, you know, some other companies, but it's certainly very comfortable. So it's not anything to be concerned about.
So let's look at the mailbag. So the question is whether we hold Amazon and Disney in addition to Netflix. Clem, do you?
I do not hold Disney because it doesn't meet my quantitative criteria. I do hold Amazon. But it's not, you know, it's not because of Amazon Prime and the streaming and whatnot. It's because of the overall company, including, you know, its AWS cloud services, including its, you know, its delivery capacity. You know, it's a strong company. So I hold it. So, you know, if you look at the Magnificent Seven companies, I hold Amazon, I hold Meta, I hold Microsoft, and I hold Nvidia, but I do not hold Tesla, and I don't hold what's the other one I'm missing, Steve? I'm being like an American politician, forgetting things.
Did you say Google?
No, I do hold Google. Okay, I do hold Alphabet. I do hold Alphabet. Right. So it's really only Tesla that I do not hold.
I've, you know, we don't hold Tesla. We don't hold Meta anymore. We did it one time. And so all the others we do hold. Yeah. So I agree. It's hard not to be a part of them, but because we're equal weighted, we don't hold nearly what the market holds in a case like Nvidia. So yeah, we're far underweight. And, you know, when you look at some of these names and what they've done, I mean, Nvidia is now almost 30% of the semiconductor index.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Which I think is, you know, when you get to that point, you're basically dominating a lot of different spaces. So
yeah, Nvidia, I've had to keep trimming back. Meta, I've had to trim back as well because it was really on a hot roll for a while. I think on Alphabet, Google, I think there's an opportunity there for actually buying some more because they've kind of stumbled with some of their AI product. I don't know if you noticed that recently.
Yep, they're a name that we added a couple of places. So everybody, thanks for listening to our podcast. If you like our podcast, please give us a like and subscribe to be notified about future episodes. And thanks for listening. Clem, do you have anything else?
Nope, that's it. It was a really great opportunity to talk to you and to everybody.
The views shared on this podcast represent the personal investment views of the hosts. They are for educational purposes and not meant to be taken as investment advice. Listeners should consult their own investment, legal, and tax advisors. Past performance of any investments is not a guarantee for future return.